May it please the court. This court has emphasized the importance for lawyers to avoid conflicts of interest with their clients, noting that no client should ever be concerned with the possible use against him in the future of what he may have revealed to his attorney. Matters disclosed by clients under the protective seal of the attorney-client relationship must not be used as weapons of offense against the client. That is precisely what happened in this case. Respondent violated his duty of loyalty by entering into repeated and serious conflicts of interest that caused significant harm to the economic interests of his clients. After stipulating to the facts, violations, and recommended sanction for this misconduct, and after accepting the decision of the disciplinary hearing panel for a 2-year suspension, respondent in his brief now disavows any responsibility for his actions and suggests that this court should dismiss the charges. He's wrong in that allegation, and this court should consider the respondent's rejection of the stipulation as an aggravator in assessing his discipline. Time does not permit a full review of all the facts and violations in this case, so allow me to highlight some of the most serious misconduct. In October of 2007, respondent was contacted by Susan Zenley to prepare estate planning documents for Anna Holtz and Stephen Bolliance. Ms. Zenley was the great-niece of Ms. Holtz and Mr. Bolliance and wanted management of their finances by taking control of their monies. You should know that Anna Holtz and Stephen Bolliance were both in their 90s. They suffered from physical and mental decline. Ms. Holtz suffered in October of 2007 from Alzheimer's disease. On October 24, 2007, respondent meets with Ms. Holtz, and has her sign the power of attorney naming Zenley as the attorney in fact. He notarizes the document himself. He does no independent inquiry as to Ms. Holtz's mental capacity, and he does no inquiry as to whether Ms. Holtz already has an estate plan, which she did. On the same day, respondent goes and meets with Mr. Bolliance, but Mr. Bolliance refuses to sign the power of attorney. Unfortunately, a week later, Mr. Bolliance suffers a stroke and is rushed to the hospital, St. Louis University Hospital, because of the stroke. Respondent goes to the hospital and has him sign the power of attorney by marking an X on the power of attorney, which he then notarizes. And only a week after, Mr. Bolliance had rejected that same document. He makes no independent inquiry as to Mr. Bolliance's mental capacity. He makes no inquiry as to whether Mr. Bolliance already has an estate plan in place, which he did. He doesn't review any of the documents with either Ms. Holtz or Mr. Bolliance before he has them sign them to make sure that they understood the import of what they were being asked to execute. After this is all in place, Ms. Senley, acting at the direction and with the assistance of the respondent, takes the following actions. On November 12, she drains the joint bank accounts belonging jointly to Ms. Holtz and Mr. Bolliance and deposits that money into a single joint account that's titled in the names of Ms. Holtz, Mr. Bolliance, and Ms. Zenley. On the same day, she cashes out all the United States savings bonds that are in the names of Ms. Holtz and Mr. Bolliance and purchases new bonds under which Zenley is named the sole payee upon death. On December 4th, she executes a warranty deed, Ms. Zenley does, transferring property titled in the names of Ms. Holtz and Mr. Bolliance to joint names of Holtz, Bolliance, and Zenley. Significantly, on the very same day she executes that warranty deed, Ms. Holtz passes away. 3 days later, on December 7th, Mr. Bolliance passes away.
I assume on the bank account, she's the only person who could sign for the money because the Bowling and Bowling weren't signed signature cards. The only signature card would have been the person who signed the account.
My guess is she probably signed those cards as under a power of attorney that had already been granted by the prior executions, if that was acceptable to the bank.
But she'd be the only signature.
But she certainly had that authority at that point, Judge Teitelman.
Right, but she'd be the only signature to be able to withdraw, because they're not being able to.
Well, they certainly were not capable, I think, at that point of writing checks, executing any transactions on their own behalf.
Who was his client at that time?
In our view, the clients at this point are Holtz, Bolliance, and Zenley. He's representing all three of them and fails to get any consents, by the way, from any of them prior to taking these actions, as would otherwise be, assuming it's even a consentable conflict, he gets no consents from any of them.
Although he has ostensibly the power of attorney, she's got the power of attorney with the ex one. She's got.
Well, it's Mr. Bowling's who signs that power of attorney with an ex.
Right.
But what's significant is that he's in the hospital. He's had a stroke a week earlier when he wasn't in the hospital, hadn't suffered that stroke.
And the one with Alzheimer's signed the document. And the one with Alzheimer's had signed it also.
She signed, notwithstanding the fact that she'd been diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease.
What excuse does he give for this behavior?
Well, in his brief, he says he was absolutely competent in everything he did for Ms. Holtz and Mr. Bowling's. He says that his actions benefited them financially, that he did them no harm.
How did it benefit
and
them?
And that was after he stipulated to these violations that I've just described.
How did it benefit them financially?
I have no idea.
Oh, well,
it certainly did not benefit them in our view. In fact, what ends up happening is the personal representative on the existing estate plans files a discovery of assets lawsuit, Judge Tottleman. And within a couple months, in early 2008, Ms. Zentley returns $860,000 of their money back to the personal representative. Personal representative then files a civil conspiracy and legal malpractice case against the respondent, and they end up with a judgment of just under $300,000 against the respondent, along with a $600,000 punitive damage award. That punitive damage award is reversed by the Court of Appeals, Eastern District of Missouri. But the significant thing here is that as of the date, December 7th, that Mr. Bowling's passed away, Ms. Zentley effectively owns all of their assets. And also of significance is that same month, just 10 days later, Ms. Zentley pays respondent a $5,000 legal fee bill using one of the accounts retitled in her name. In early 2008, respondent prepares an estate plan for Ms. Zentley and her husband. And in the course of preparing that estate plan, he recommends to Ms. Zentley that she and her husband should invest their funds with the financial service LLC that the respondent happens to own, along with other lawyers at his law firm. And so the conflicts are just varied and just run throughout that representation. The Forbeck case is equally disturbing. In the Forbeck case, it's count two of our information, again, a third party, a caretaker, Joanne Mulkey, contacts the respondent and asks the respondent to draft estate planning documents. He does so. Those estate planning documents, among those documents, Mulkey is given power of attorney over Forbeck, and Mulkey and the respondent are named as co-trustees of the existing trust that Mr. Forbeck has. Very soon thereafter, Mr. Forbeck's family becomes concerned that Mulkey is exerting undue influence and stealing assets from Mr. Forbeck, and they file a petition for emergency guardianship and conservatorship in Lincoln County. Temporary letters are issued by the judge, and attorney Chris Menemeyer is appointed a GAL for Mr. Forbeck. After learning of that order and the fact there's now a GAL in place, Mr. Menemeyer, a respondent engages in the following misconduct. First, he goes to the nursing home where Mr. Forbeck is residing, Ellsbury Healthcare Center, and he, for the purpose of having Mr. Forbeck examined by a gerontologist that he brings with him. The facility administrator, being aware of the temporary letters that have been issued, objects to him entering the facility and meeting with Mr. Forbeck unless either Mr. Forbeck gives consent or the GAL, more properly, gives consent to that visit. Respondent ignores those objections, goes into the facility, meets with Mr. Forbeck, and only leaves the facility after the administrator threatens him with arrest, calling the police and having him arrested for being on the premises. He thereafter enters his appearance for Mr. Forbeck in the guardianship and conservatorship proceedings and files numerous pleadings on behalf of Mr. Forbeck without Mr. Forbeck's knowledge or consent. He has not consented to him acting as his attorney. He drafts an amendment to Mr. Forbeck's trust that Mr. Forbeck never knew about and did not authorize. And who signs that amendment? Mulkey, who has the power of attorney. When the guardianship case is closed, respondent, not being happy with the results, files a notice of appeal on behalf of Mr. Forbeck in the Court of Appeals, on behalf of Forbeck and himself. Mr. Forbeck had no knowledge that he was going to do so and did not consent to that filing. in that filing, he represented to the court, the Missouri Court of Appeals, that he was acting as the attorney for Mr. Forbeck, 8.4C. For all of these unauthorized actions, the respondent bills and was paid $12,500 by Ms. Mulkey. And where did that money come from? From Mr. Forbeck's trust. The violations are numerous, they're extensive, they're serious. 8.4C, dishonesty in terms of his representation to the court, he was representing Mr. Forbeck. 4-1.2, by continuing to represent Mr. Forbeck without his knowledge or consent. 4-1.7, in both cases, just runs throughout the representations. He's representing people with conflicting and adverse interests without getting any waivers, informed consents.
Now, why do you recommend on the ABA guidance, would the influence your recommendation of 2 years as opposed to any other discipline?
Judge Tottleman, we stipulated to a 2-year actual suspension based on ABA standard 4.32, saying that suspension is appropriate when a lawyer knows of a conflict, doesn't fully disclose the possible effect of that conflict to the client, and causes injury or potential injury to the client. That clearly happened here. In addition, in agreeing to that, frankly, I also analyzed the court's decisions in the past, the most recent, the Williams case, looked at the Weir case some years ago in 1999, Coleman, Carey and Donnie, which was decided by the court in 2002, and the Snyder case. This clearly is much more serious than any of those cases, but the sanction of 2 years is also a greater sanction than any of those cases.
Carey and Donnie was a discovery dispute, and I don't think they had any discipline before, and it was a 6-month suspension.
No, I absolutely concur, Judge. The fact is that this is much more serious, and then on top of everything else, after stipulations are entered, agreements are made, the panel recommendation is approved by both parties, a brief gets filed where he just disavows that all of that and says you ought to dismiss these charges. I don't acknowledge anything.
Do you want to change your disposition?
Well, I don't want to touch to the court to do what they please. And the stipulation, by its terms, says that the parties are only making a recommendation to the court. The panel is only making a recommendation. Right. It's only advisory. The court can do with it as they see fit. And certainly, given circumstances since that day that we signed that stip, I think that the court could reasonably conclude that additional aggravators are present that warrant a more severe sanction.
Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Pretzel.
Thank you.
Case will be submitted.